Yeah, here we are. Rock to Recovery Radio. And I think it might be episode 12. I think that's what we're on right now, episode 12. But who knows? Is it really important? It's really not. So I'm your host, Wesley Gear. Like I said, this is Rock to Recovery Radio. We are on, the phones are already going crazy. That's not my phone. We are on KX93.5 FM, Human Crafted Radio, Laguna's only FM. This show is brought to you also by New Vista Behavioral Health. They are friends of mine, but they're an amazing program that helps a lot of different types of people that need treatment for various disorders, addiction, mental health, etc. So we thank you to those people for bringing us on the air and giving us the chance to do this. Why are we here? Why is Rock to Recovery Radio here? Because I'm passionate about recovery. The station wanted a recovery radio show, and it just kind of worked out that we get to have this amazing show. And what we do is we interview rad humans or celebrities, rock stars, all sorts of cool people who've had a recovery story of their own. But the thing we like to highlight is for so many, it's not just about recovering and surviving and having this just mundane, horrible, depressive life. It's about recovering and getting into what we, I like to call it the vortex of radness, when it's like, what? Life can be this good? Who knew? So in our endeavor to bring you rad guests, wow, we got a special one tonight. I can't wait to get into this. I did a little reading. I never like to go too far because I like the discovery portion of it all. But we got a gentleman, and correct me if I misspeak on any of this, but played with Iggy Pop. Played with New York Dolls. Yeah. Chubby Checker. Right? Did I miss anybody?
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Jerry Lee Lewis. That's right. Oh, my gosh.
Little Richard.
I mean, come on. This is insane. And what was it the same instrument in all?
Yeah. I'm a bass player, mainly because nobody else wanted to do it.
And it worked out for you.
It worked out.
Right. And so we're here with Michael Page. Michael Page, welcome. So stoked you're here.
Thank you. And
he went on to do some other amazing stuff, which we can get into a little later in the story. So thank you for making the pilgrimage out of Los Angeles down here.
I haven't been to Laguna Beach for a while, a long time, but I just kind of forgot how beautiful it is.
It's not a bad place to come to, is it?
Just beautiful. We watch the sunset down the street.
Oh, I love it.
Attitude of gratitude.
Yeah, it's a big deal, isn't it?
So thankful.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too. I'm really into like law of attraction and energy and stuff. And when we're in that grateful place, the energy that's coming out of us is just so good to bring more of that stuff that we're grateful for, right?
I had it explained to me by a friend once that had a recovery clinic or whatever, right? And he was doing really, really well, was really successful with his business. And when he looked at my background, he said, we have a lot of things in common.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought maybe he was talking about music. And he said, no, it's guys like us that when we wake up each morning with our face knotted in the mud is a day in paradise.
Yeah.
Normal people probably couldn't understand that or don't need to understand it, but we live differently.
Yeah.
Grateful for not having to live the way that we were living.
Not to wake up and grab a syringe, not to wake up and grab a whiskey bottle, not to wake up and look for a bindle of cocaine, not to wake up and go, oh, another day of this hell? Why?
You have the opportunity to live life.
Yeah.
On life's terms.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah. I remember the days of towards the end for me of waking up and just like, I didn't want to get loaded, but I had to because otherwise I wouldn't be able to literally walk across the room. And it was so miserable. Like, this again? Ugh, miserable. So, but this isn't about me. It's about you, my friend. And like I said, I'm stoked you're here. So.
Well, that's not entirely true. I didn't know that you were the guitar player with Korn.
That's true.
And it was like, oh, my gosh. So, actually, I wanted to turn this around and do an interview you.
Oh, shoot. Well,
I had a lot of questions. Are you originally from Laguna Beach?
No, no. I'm originally from all over the place.
From all over. Where, basically, what area?
Born in Fullerton. And
Southern California.
Yeah, then at 5, I went to Massachusetts when my parents split up. And then at 10, came back, and it was Fountain Valley, Yorba Linda, El Toro, Lake Forest, you name it, Costa
and
Mesa.
You started getting interested in music at a young age.
Yeah, 14. You have switched the tables on me, haven't you?
14.
Yeah.
That's when...
14 or 15, yeah.
Do you remember the songs?
Well, I grew up on classical music, right? My family was, classical musicians. So when I heard my brother play Smoke on the Water, which is a simple fourths, it was like, and I was like, what is that? Because it stuck out instead of like this beautiful, you know what I mean, melodic interplay of everything. And then I think for me after that, it was certain things. It was like the twang of B-52's guitar. It was Eddie Van Halen down tuning because he was down to D sharp and would drop. So it was C sharp. I love that chunky guitar. And then hearing hammer-ons like Randy Rhoads and Eddie Van Halen doing Eruption and all that stuff, I was like, I gotta learn how to make
so
these sounds.
So you started out playing guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
Guitar was your first instrument.
I played trumpet when I was a kid, but that doesn't count.
Did you have music in your family?
Yeah.
I mean, did your family play?
Yeah, yeah.
Did they play instruments?
My grandma played violin in the Boston Pops, and my grandfather was the music director of a church in Cohasset. So he taught everybody every instrument and arranged music for the carillon, which is the bell tower where each note of the piano is a bell. So he would take classical pieces and was famous for transposing. And these levers are hard to push, but he would go through like Bach on there. And he could tour the bell towers, but of course there's only so many. But he was kind of he was a rock star in that sense, yeah.
When did you actually start thinking about possibly, I mean, you start playing in bands. How old were you when you start playing bands?
Oh, I don't know, in the first band. I mean, we had the first garage band with, like, no drummer and no singer when I was, like, 16, yeah. Yeah, and you name it and all that. Yeah, the dream started really early, yeah.
But then you developed into, at one point did you want to do it as a career, or did you think of it doing it as a career?
Oh, very early on. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and then, he has switched this on me. I'm going to switch it back, though.
I'm definitely interested in this.
Early on. It was basically, and my friends would say, you don't think you can make it. Because back then, making was a whole different thing. Getting the record deal, you couldn't self-produce at home like nowadays. And I would turn on the radio and go, well, I can do that. I can play that song. Why can't I make it? Why not? You know, it was a little more... I don't know. It seemed a little more obtainable than if I went to see like a violinist virtuoso play. Like I can't do that. I can't touch that. But I could listen to like, you know, Motley Crue and Iron Maiden and Dead Kennedys and B-52s and go, yeah, I could pull that off. Let's go.
That's interesting. All that music is like, it's different for me. When I was young, I was introduced to blues.
Yeah.
Really lucked out.
Yeah.
I was with a group of older guys that turned me on to Howlin' Wolf and Robert Johnson, Charlie Patton, mm-hmm. all those things in the beginning. This is just right around Beatles time.
Mm.
So, and when the Stones came out.
So it's mid-60s?
I'm really bad with years.
Yeah, me
and
too.
All that, really bad.
Yeah.
A lot of lost years, mm-hmm. whatever. But I was really lucky because to have that as a foundation, for your musical foundation, it's only three chords, basically.
Right. 1-4-5.
But it's also the root of all music.
It's feeling.
Rock and roll, three chords.
Yeah.
I always say everything breaks down to Louie Louie. Mm. Just your three chord mm-hmm. rock and roll is the important things. And, you know, I got a gig with Chubby Checker, playing with Chubby.
Right.
I played with Chubby for a lot of years, 340 shows a year.
Wow.
I
don't think anybody, if this is a trivia question, how many shows did Chubby Checker play per year? Anybody even come close to that? That's insane.
No, I got a trivia question. How did you know how Chubby's got his, you know what his name is?
No.
Chubby was discovered by Dick Clark and his wife.
Okay.
And they were in Pennsylvania at a farmer's market, and they heard somebody singing.
Okay.
And they followed the voice, and they found Chubby plucking chickens in an alley in a farmer's market thing.
Wow.
So they talked with him and told him, you have a really interesting voice. Would you be interested in possibly singing? And
right.
we can record. And he said, absolutely. So they set it up, and he recorded a really stupid folk song or whatever. And And then when it came time to make a record, they said, well, his name is Ernest Evans. And they said, that's not going to fly. At the time, they had Fabian and
right.
people had stage names.
Yeah.
So I asked him who Chubby's favorite singer was, and he said it was Fats Domino was his favorite singer. So it was Dick Clark's wife put Fats Domino with Chubby.
Oh, my Chubby. Gosh, it makes so much
name.
Sense. Chubby Checker, Fats Domino.
That's a good one.
It's so obvious.
And it was so
How
much
did we not figure that
fun
out?
Every night singing shibop 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 shibop. Shibop 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 shibop.
That's so
like,
cool.
How did I get here? How did I do this? This is just absolutely amazing.
That's so cool. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
That's a fun one.
Love and those stories.
Of
yeah.
course, the people that we would play with, those were doing shows with Pat Boone and the Monkees, the Grassroots. I just told my buddy we did a show. The Monkees, the Seeds. And this isn't back in the day. This is like after the Dolls, the whole thing, just before I got my gig with Iggy Pop.
Right.
So, but, I mean, for the experience of getting to travel the world, everybody wants to do the twist and have fun, and it brings back a real positive thing.
Yeah.
Every night, people come up and do the limbo.
Uh-huh.
And, The Pony, The Fly, The Hucklebuck, The Twist, Let's Twist Again, Mashed Potatoes, all those songs, my favorite songs in the world as a little kid growing up and just playing them in the band. And being a bass player is not real challenging, so I would spend my energy on enjoying the crowd and the energy.
Yeah.
But we're doing shows with Little Richard and Chuck Berry, Fats Domino. I got to be friends with all these guys.
Wow.
And bottom line is I'm a hardcore fan. And I would listen to these people that are just like my gods and my idols.
Yeah.
And next thing, knowing them and hanging and being on first name basis was just a thrill.
I
can
imagine.
That's a lot of shows to play in a year. Many of them, two nights, two shows a night.
Yeah.
Whatever. But you know, I'm young, good looking, pretty much footloose and fancy free.
Yeah.
And we're playing in places like Swaziland and Africa.
Wow.
Which I fell in love with Africa, and I was there when apartheid was going on the first time. And my second trip back, I was in Cape Town. I fell in love with the place, with the music and the people and the whole thing. Actually, I'm trying to work to get back to Africa.
That I'm was sure you'll
the,
do it.
All the places that I've been, that's the one. Who would have thunk when I got there?
Life's kind of that way. Right, it kind of, it's the stuff that you think you won't like is like, wow, I'm glad I tried that, whatever it is, because now that's my favorite thing. And all those songs you did, what I wanted to point out, some people may not know, they're all dances that went along with the songs. Yeah,
yeah.
Like so it was kind of a thing you did back then, like if you're going to write a hit, you wanted a dance to go along with it, the twist, the mashed potato, all that. I think they got the Running Man and the Moonwalk, and then after that it was kind of Cabbage Patch.
We did a show
at
the Chicago Fest. It's the largest outdoor festival of the U.S.
Yeah.
And with Little Richard and Chuck Berry Bo Diddley and Chubby.
Wow.
We're playing the song, and I'm looking at 200,000 people over there, and he's singing The Fly. And The Fly has got this dance of like it's like a soupy sales thing or whatever. And you see all those people all doing that. It was just absolutely
incredible. Nobody would have a clue these days, except the older crowd, but like younger kids, I don't know that they go back that far to the music. I know a lot of kids are discovering Doors, Zeppelin, and the Beatles and stuff, but that classic rock and roll, such a beautiful time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So tell me, okay, let's tie in your story of addiction, where that took place. When did you pick up?
Well, I found out later that I have a lot of my family, that my grandfather... I think my father found my grandfather dead of alcohol poisoning during Prohibition. He had drank bathtub gin or whatever. So I found out later that it runs in the family.
So that's like the 30s when they had Prohibition, yeah?
You know, so I'm trying to figure out when...
We already decided we're not good with years.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was a natural... It seemed like it was a natural transition. What do you do at 2 o'clock in the morning after you finish playing a show?
You got
couple hundred thousand people. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. How do you go to bed?
Yeah.
And then you jump on the bus and do it all over again.
Yeah.
And after you do that for a while, drinking was just a part of what it was. And I was always a good drunk. Mm-hmm. I was always responsible. I would never be drunk for a show.
Yeah.
But when you're done, that's just what you do. You jump on the bus and you drink yourself to sleep or whatever. After doing that for years and years... alcohol never really played a problem with any of the stuff back in New York. Everybody was, you know, they drank or whatever alcohol.
Seemed normal.
Back then it was dope. That was the big one. And, of course, I got
dope
hooked up.
Dope meaning heroin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I got hooked up with the Dolls with Johnny Thunders and all that. Sylvain always kept me away from Johnny for a good reason for that. Because all that stuff, it just doesn't work.
So first you're drinking, right? And it was no big deal. Everybody drinks. I'm drinking after the show. You're not getting in trouble. And who are you playing with at that time?
Well, I've been touring since I can remember.
Yeah.
So I did it kind of too much. I did it for a lot of years.
Yeah.
Nonstop for a lot of years.
What was the first band you toured with?
Well, as a kid, I played with the King Biscuit Blues Band.
And, I heard about that.
We were based in San Diego, and doing those kind of Robert Johnson, Charlie Patton stuff. It was just pre-Canned Heat, about the time Canned Heat was coming out. There weren't any white blues bands. John Mayall in England, that was about it. But I met a girl, Elizabeth Ballard, in San Diego. She was from La Jolla, and she had a talk with me. It told me, you know, you don't belong here in this town. If you have aspirations to do things. And you'll be in the best blues band in San Diego when you're an old man. You need to come and check out and see what's going on in New York. There's there's painters, there's sculptors, there's art is happening, rock and roll music is happening. There's a cultural explosion happening. You owe it to yourself to check it out.
Right.
So at some point, I end up moving to New York City against all my friends.
We're not sure what year that is.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you. This is really interesting, too, what was happening. I was engaged to be married with a girl. And she fell in love with Iggy.
Oh.
Right?
And this is when, after you went to New York.
Like
you
this,
went to New York.
Before, it was the reason I went to New York.
For the, okay, right.
So she fell in love with Iggy, and which obviously we're not getting married anymore.
Right.
Iggy wasn't into having a relationship or whatever.
Right.
And so I ended up heartbroken in San Diego, and it was like, I don't want to be here anymore in this town. It's time, I think it was 21 years old, and it was time to experiment to see what was going on. Well, this girl telling me you should come back, you can stay at my place.
Even though I'm going to try to get with Iggy, you can stay at my place?
No, this is another girl, Elizabeth Ballard, the girl that told me that I owed it to her. So she was in Little Italy in New York, and I took her up on it. Mm-hmm. And I went back. I had nothing to lose.
Right.
And I went back to New York, and I wanted to check out this band, the New York Dolls.
Right.
And I wanted to see what was going on with them, because I saw they were voted the best new band of the year, Rolling Stone, and the worst new band of the year at the same time.
Right.
And I just loved their shit.
Isn't it always like that? Yeah, it's like Led Zeppelin gets a bad review, Prince got a bad review. I mean, you know, it seems like a lot of great bands.
Well, when the Dolls came out, it was a pretty boring music situation at the time, and they came, just kicked the doors in with this American kick-ass Rolling Stone type rock and roll, and their personalities and the whole thing. It was just crazy. And it opened, it started the fire in New York, the Mercer Arts Center and the whole thing. It started a giant movement. And it was funny, after I got back there and started meeting all the musicians, I saw the Ramones. Everybody was inspired by the New York Dolls. They were kings in New York.
Yeah.
So I go back to visit this girl, and Elizabeth, and I got involved in theater. She knew theater people. So I got my first job with John Waters, the movie. Now he's movie
director.
Heard
the name, yeah.
Back then he was doing, it was right around Pink Flamingo's time. And he was doing off-Broadway theater productions. So I got hired to play the music, score the music for the off-Broadway productions. It's all theater.
You're a busy man at a young age.
All the people in Lou Reed's song, Take a Walk on the Wild Side, they were all the people I was associating with. Jackie thought she was James Dean for a day. That was Jackie Curtis.
Wow.
Taylor Mead, Sugar Plum Fairy. All these people were local people that lived in the village that this girl introduced me to, and got me hooked up at the Theater of the Ridiculous, and which is a very avant-garde underground New York thing. So I got involved in theater, writing music for that person. I happened to run into a girl, physically knocked into her in the street, Janet Planet, and spilled coffee on her. And she started screaming at me, "You idiot, why don't you watch what you're doing? Mike Page, what are you doing here?" And I was like, "Janet, what are you doing here?"
Oh, my gosh.
So I told her, "I want to check out this band, the New York Dolls." She tells me, "I'm marrying the guitar player, Sylvain. He's right around the corner. You want to meet him?"
Wow.
Within, I don't know, 10 days or whatever, they were having problems with Arthur, with this drug and alcohol thing. And I looked like an identical twin.
I wish I could see a picture of you.
At the time, it's pretty hilarious. So that was my intention, was to try to get in with the Dolls. They were breaking up right then. Johnny and Jerry were doing the Heartbreakers, and they were going to reform as the new New York Dolls or whatever. We started our own group called the Criminals. It was three, four of the Dolls and myself, and got a record deal with RCA. And then that's when I got a job offer for Chubby Checker.
Wow.
And I knew that was going to be. And Chubby hired me to modernize his band, because we were all wearing red patent leather. When they showed up, he goes,
"Not you
that,
want some of that
not
New York
that
Dolls
modern.
Flavor. Yeah.
Not that modern."
So let's take a quick break here and throw in the first song that you selected, right? Do you want to set it up?
Which song is it?
New York Dolls, Personal Crisis. Personality Crisis, New York Dolls.
We got a New York Dolls song.
Oh.
That you wanted to play, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You want to set up this song?
It speaks for itself.
You think so? All right. Why didn't I don't know what song you picked.
Personality Crisis.
New York City.
Yeah. All right. So here we are. Rock to Recovery Radio. We're here with Michael Page. This is New York Dolls. Song is still so relevant to where we're at with celebrity and Instagram models. Hey, we're back on Rock to Recovery Radio. This is Wes Geer, and I'm your host on KX 93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM. And it's also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. And we're sitting here with a legend in his own right, bass player for Iggy Pop, New York Dolls, Chubby Checker. I mean, the list goes on and on. The Criminals. Don't forget.
Rosie Flores.
Rosie Flores. He's played with every... It's just rock and roll royalty all the way through. All the way through. So, Mr. Michael Page, we're talking about your story and how you moved to New York after some heartbreak. And you got in the New York Dolls, right?
Well, the Dolls thing was really... It was breaking up right at the time. So, Sylvain, it was... I pretty much kind of started hanging out with Syl through Janet. Mm-hmm. And... gave him the confidence of what that he could do something on his own. He had written a lot of the songs and was a good singer or whatever. It was all being negotiated. Then David got his solo album. David Johansen got his solo album. So we split off. Instead of doing the new New York Dolls or whatever, we formed the Criminals and got our gig there. But the big thing about New York was the community of what was happening.
Right.
When I first went to CBGB's the first time, because I'm a West Coast guy, San Diego, I'd go to get Rock Scene magazine, just like surfers get Surfer magazine or golfers get Golf Digest.
Yeah.
I would get Rock Scene and Circus and Cream and all this and look at the rock and roll guys, the bands that were happening, and would see what was happening in New York. And I'd never been involved in a scene where it was so supportive. Every night we would go out to CBGB's, Max's Kansas City, Gildersleeve, there's a small handful of clubs, mainly CBGB's and Max's, and there was support. We'd go see the Dead Boys. They would come and see us play.
That's
then we'd
so
see
cool.
the Ramones, we'd see Blondie and the Talking Heads. And there was a lot
That's
of the
amazing.
Music there that I really wasn't getting. I saw Devo the first time with five people in the audience, and they were mind-blowing. I saw a television play. The first time, I didn't get
television.
It went over my head. I didn't get it.
Yeah.
There was a lot of non-musical stuff where I came from a background. You had to be a musician.
You were playing blues, and some of the more theatrical stuff was probably a little bit weird, huh?
Yeah, people were... But then being exposed to the theater part was more of an expanding thing.
Yeah, so...
But it was a communal deal, and there was movements that were happening. All started from the Dolls.
That's amazing.
And then,
and we've seen similar stuff like that happen in Los Angeles. I went through it with some of the bands, and it was like Korn and Deftones and System of a Down and Incubus. We all played together, and I don't know, are there scenes like that in America anymore? It doesn't feel like it.
Well, scenes have always changed, right?
Yeah. Just doesn't seem the same as it used to be.
Then London.
Yeah.
Then Seattle.
London's always been good.
I hear now Florida. I just don't know about music now.
I know. We get a little older.
I do have a fun story for this. I introduced my daughter. I was working with David Bowie a little bit, and I went to go see him play with Tin Machine, and I brought my daughter. And my daughter, Nina, I think she was 4 or 5 years old. David ended up giving her piggyback rides around the dressing room.
And incredible.
And she was her uncle's like... her Uncle David and her Uncle Iggy, whatever, her girlfriends growing up.
That's amazing.
That didn't mean anything to any of them at the time. But
what an amazing time you got to grow up in.
Yeah.
Just being around all that. Music was so pure. And
from New York, there was so much going on in New York. And also, then it bled into the manager, Malcolm McLaren, was managing the Dolls back in New York. And Malcolm took, he had a shop called Sex. Mm-hmm. That was a clothing store.
Yeah.
Working with Vivian Westwood,
yeah,
was a designer. Now she's big designer, has been for
years, yeah.
But Malcolm went back and had taken what he had learned from the Dolls about manipulating the media,
right?
And started the Sex Pistols. Malcolm owned the name, the Sex Pistols. He owned Johnny Rotten name.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that they were kind of like the first boy band, if you will.
Yeah, the Sex Pistols put together like
put
that.
Together,
but also
yeah.
Was the timing was right.
Perfect, was, yeah.
There's a lot of bad stuff going on in England. It was. No Future, whatever was going on.
The music's
they
great.
They based a three-chord rock thing with a different
so good.
Deal. So then the scene went to there.
So let's talk a little bit about where your addiction is going. So you're in the scene. You said you're drinking and using, right? And when did it went? And it was okay. That's what everybody was doing. And we were talking about on the break. Back then, it's not like now where we know kind of the pitfalls of addiction. We know how many people have died. We've watched rock stars not make it into adult life, right? The 27 Club, et cetera, et cetera. But back then, there wasn't so much knowledge about it. It was
absolutely
kind of experimenting.
None.
So when did you start, when did it start twisting from drinking and hanging out with all these cool people in the scene to like, wow, this is not so good. I have a problem. I'm taking it too far. What was the first?
Well, it actually happened after the last tour that I did with Iggy was called The Breaking Point.
Yeah. And you were just drinking on that tour?
Yeah.
I was
just drinking. When
did you
drugs
pick...
weren't really allowed.
Who didn't allow him? Iggy?
Iggy wouldn't allow drugs.
Did Iggy drink back then?
I wasn't interested in drugs anyway, really.
You weren't
I mean,
there?
Coke. We all did Coke. I didn't think of that as being a
okay,
drug.
Okay, wait, right?
That's not it.
Let's quantify that statement. This is so great for addicts and stuff. We love to do that. I used to do that with weed. Well, weed's not really a drug.
Yeah, beer.
There was
not,
no drugs allowed. Iggy didn't allow drugs. I mean, well, Coke, but that doesn't count. We're talking cocaine here. I mean... That's a drug, my man. I mean, so let me get this straight. Iggy was like, hey.
Well, see, we did cocaine when it wasn't addictive.
Well, okay. Oh, wow. Okay, I never tried that.
Nobody ever thought about any of that.
Well, you didn't know, right? It was like cocaine.
It was just something
stuff.
You did. Right. It was like, you know, you drink a lot, and then you got a show coming up, and you drank
a little
too much.
Got to do some blow.
So you got to come up to it.
Yeah, but it's not a drug. It's just cocaine.
Then it ends
so
up
what,
just being
what,
not
here's
fun.
The question. What was a drug? So Iggy doesn't allow drugs, but drinking and cocaine, which isn't a drug, is okay. What is the line that is like, hey, don't have that back here? Would it be heroin?
Yeah.
That would be it? And
yeah.
But what about like mushroom and acid? Did anybody care about that?
No, I think people kind of outgrew that. Really.
They outgrew it? They didn't care?
Yeah. It's just the things of the day or whatever.
Because I feel like if people are on acid or mushrooms, you're like, oh, you're just tripping. It's no big deal. But people start doing heroin and speed. You're like, whoa, dude.
Right.
That's some heavy, you know.
Yeah.
What.
Well, the last tour we did called The Breaking Point. It was, I think, Japan.
Ominous
Hawaii,
words.
Japan, Hawaii, Australia, whatever. It was a long
tour. This is with Iggy?
Yeah. And we figured somebody was probably going to die on that tour.
Just from drinking and cocaine.
Yeah, well, the amount of everything that we were doing.
I say
doing.
Just from drinking and cocaine. Yeah. I mean, anybody knows drinking
the
and
amount,
cocaine, you can get pretty...
The amounts we were doing were... People die. And,
people
you know,
die.
You don't really think of that while you're doing it.
Right.
Kind of a lot of that stuff we kind of invented.
It was new. Had you seen any ODs at this time? Like, whoa, the weirdest thing happened the other night, so-and-so.
Yeah. Not really my close friends. Because
but you heard rumors and stories.
See, the dope thing, when you do dope, you associate with that. Everyone knows where
right.
that's going, and you end up a junkie and you die.
Yeah.
The alcohol thing takes a lot longer.
It's a slow one.
It's more socially accepted until you get stupid or whatever. Coke was seemed to be more of a fad or whatever that came. People needed to try it out. But I didn't get my problems happened when I decided to stop touring. I had toured for so many years. And the last tour that I did with Iggy, we were flying back on the plane, and he had a talk with me and saying, you know, I might not be able to keep you on retainer because he would put me on retainer.
Gotcha. So for people who don't know, that's when you're home not touring, you still get a paycheck. So
that's
you're
right,
getting
right.
paid
I
even though
a,
the band's
I
not
had
active.
I had an opportunity to tour with Billy Idol.
Wow.
Because I played in some good bands and he had a good name
sure.
at the time. So I had opportunities to do that, but then I would be paid. To keep my health together and to be fresh.
So when you
tour.
After the last tour with Iggy, did you no longer got retainer?
Well, on the plane, on the way home, we talked about it. I introduced him to his girl at the time, Suchi, who he ended up marrying from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he had gotten a couple movie offers, a couple different things, and was thinking of just taking a break for a while.
Yeah.
And probably wouldn't be able to keep me on retainer. Didn't know the direction of what he was going to do, but he wanted to...
How'd
down.
You take that?
It made total sense, and I wanted.
Were you okay with it?
Yeah,
because you get gigs endlessly anyhow.
I met
like,
a girl,
yeah, right.
and I wanted to get married. I wanted to have an address. I hadn't had an address. People don't understand what that's like. If you don't have an address and you can't,
you're a road dog.
Yeah, and which was fun for a long, long time.
So, but how old are you about at this point?
Probably getting around 30.
Right.
Or whatever it was like.
So
it was,
you're like, hey, I would like to actually have a home to call my
home.
Own.
And so I met a girl, and we decided to do that. And it happened at perfect timing. We just did a tour with the Rolling Stones.
Wow.
And, you know, how much more can I do in this? It's like I exceeded my expectations.
With music.
So, I didn't expect any of that.
Yeah.
So it was all just gravy and everything and fun. But then it got to be a point where it was more, not that it was work. I don't know. It was the next natural transgression. I think of myself as being more than just a traveling, touring. There's more to life.
Sure. I think so all of us musicians.
On that tour, I ended up moving to Northern California, Mendocino. Mm-hmm. My dad had a big racehorse ranch up there, and we had a baby. And I became kind of a regular guy and lost my interest in touring, traveling. I'd pretty much seen it and wanted to get into the next phase of what it was. That's when I started running into the problems, because I was used to waking up and having a glass of wine or whatever it was. And my drinking is, like I said, I was never bullish or a mean drunk.
Right.
I'd repeat myself and get a little slurry or whatever, but never really bothersome. But right. As I learned later, it's a fatal progressive disease.
Yeah.
And it would get worse and worse. And I would recognize, and I had plenty of money and things to do, but you can't live that lifestyle and be a normal person.
Do you think, did you get sad? Did you miss music? Was that transition weird? No, you were cool with it.
No, I was totally into ready to try something new. Besides music, I didn't know what acting or what. I wanted to do soundtracks for a film. I could still participate in music, but not have to travel. But I had an interest in doing soundtracks, and that's what I eventually got into.
Because when I did that transition, and I wanted that on one level, there was this other level where I was really depressed, so I didn't know. But you didn't have that, so that's good.
No.
So when did you go to the next level? You're drinking wine at home, and you said, did you start doing heroin?
Oh, well, I would just disguise that for coffee, and a clear coffee cup wine would look like coffee, and my life would
catch
me.
So now you're starting to hide it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we do.
And then it just got worse and worse, and it's like...
Did you start doing heroin?
Then it got... Well, I did heroin when I got a couple times in New York, but Sylvain kept it away from me and kept me away from all the people that
tried to isolate
that kind of
you.
Thing.
Yeah.
And the reputation, junkies are just...
So you didn't go down the junkie road?
Not at that time. I did later when I got a divorce and life became painful and I couldn't handle the pain. You would do dope and it would completely erase it immediately.
So
and
how
you
do
know
we
that
get...
That's not a solution for anything. It comes back the next day, but when it gets heavy, it's a one-way, it's a ticket out, temporary, but we all know where that leads to.
It's a temporary solution, right? So how did that transition? You went home, you had a baby, the drinking's getting a little more. What led up to the divorce or the picking up dope? Was it the divorce?
Well, it was all alcohol, mm-hmm. looking back on it now.
Alcohol was causing problems with the marriage.
It was causing the problems. Yeah. And my wife, who I met when we were partying, I asked her to come.
Right.
We were playing with the Stones in Paris. We want to come marry me in Paris and with the Rolling Stones. She said, of course, I wasn't
Who could say no to
she
that?
She was a party girl.
I would say yes to marrying you.
She was a
Rolling Stones in Paris.
A party girl also, and having fun with me doing it. But then when she got pregnant, she was a mom, and she stopped all that. I didn't stop it. That's
a big defining moment.
That's where
change
started happening.
Yeah, I talked to a lot of friends about that. And like, some of us grow up, the people you party with, they kind of either go one of two ways. They either like hang up their beer mug and, you know, become adults, or like you and I, what you just said, we don't stop. We keep going, and then it progresses. Right.
Yeah, and either you die, and I see guys like Iggy is not alcoholic. He would drink like a fish, and it would almost kill him, but he just stop.
Yeah.
And I would try to stop like alcoholics do for periods of time and switch from beer to wine. And blah, blah. We
Scotch
know
to brandy.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'd go periods of time without drinking. But it never really seemed to hinder anything, the kind of jobs that I was doing, working in guitar stores.
Yeah. Or,
I started building Taylor guitars and...
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
down in San Diego?
Worked as a luthier. I was taken in and I ended up getting a Gibson certificate and a Fender certificate.
Wow.
So I could do guitar. And as long as I had my hands on guitars or doing music or whatever, I was happy. And that was one thing that was going to happen. But the drinking progressed more and more.
And caused problems with your marriage.
It,
and then you guys got a divorce.
We got divorced and it was, I would say, 98% of... The alcohol.
Just the drinking, yeah.
Thing.
And
so,
you said at the time you didn't really think it was, right? Which usually we don't. We're like, what? What's your problem? Right?
That's right. I don't have a problem. I like Tom Waits said, I don't have a problem unless I can't find a drink.
Yeah, yeah. And then so you get a divorce, and then how'd you fall into doing dope again?
That was you could see where that road was going to go. And I guess I wasn't born with a junkie mentality,
mm-hmm.
so I ended up walking away from that. Same with cocaine. Cocaine was a time when it was, this is not fun anymore. This is just stupid. You're just doing this as a maintenance thing. It's dumb. So I ended up just walking away. We never, ever had a problem with that. Dope, you know where that's going to go. And I got sick with withdrawals and whatever.
Right, dope
I
sick.
Wasn't that enough into it that much where I could see where that was heading, and I pulled out of that. Alcohol had me by the balls. And it
gotcha.
Was just something that I just naturally gravitated to.
So today, in today's lexicon, they would say your drug of choice was alcohol.
Yeah.
Right? So.
And it would end up, it's just disgusting when you think about. And then, you have no hope.
So you're drinking all day, every day.
You're drinking all day,
waking
every
up,
day.
Wine.
I would have
your
to
wife's
do,
left you.
I'd have to do a quart of vodka in the morning to stop from shaking. And then I got the delirium tremens
mm-hmm.
and alcohol withdrawal seizures. So I found out you can die from an alcohol withdrawal seizure. I didn't know that.
Right.
You don't die from heroin withdrawal.
No.
But you can die from... So
alcohol and benzos are the two things that can kill you with seizures. When you're detoxing, if you don't have a medical detox, they can kill you.
I had to test that. I didn't believe that, so I had to test it.
Somebody told you ahead of time, you're like,
I had six alcohol withdrawal seizures. I was hospitalized that many times.
Six times.
Hopeless and helpless. A garden variety. I end up being a garden variety homeless.
That hurts my heart because I'm bonding with you here and loving this person, Michael Page, and knowing that
it
you went through
that.
It
hurt my friends. It hurt my family. It destroyed everything that I was.
And so how'd you get out? Wait, actually, we're going to pause right there, and we're going to throw in your next song.
There we go.
This is, oh, man. I thank you so much for sharing with us, Michael Page. And do you know what this next song is?
I believe it's an inspirational, I think it's a David Bowie song.
David Bowie?
Word on a Wing. What is it?
Word on a Wing?
Oh, yeah, yes. I love this song.
So why did you select this song?
It's an emotional... actually, the song, I thought it was about my girlfriend, Shannon, but it was about finding him being at his desperate, most rock-bottom time of his life where he wanted to end it all, and he had a vision of Jesus.
Huh. I didn't know
the
that.
The song is about Jesus. I thought it was about my girlfriend.
So here we are, Rock to Recovery Radio, here with Michael Page. This is David Bowie. That voice. voice. Oh, so heart-wrenching. I love it. So, hey, we are here back with Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Geer, and we're on KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM station. This show is brought to you by, of course, KX93.5 and New Vista Behavioral Health. And we're sitting here with my new friend. I just love you, man, and you're sharing from the heart. I appreciate that. Michael Page. And we're talking about your story playing with these rock and roll legends and David Bowie and Iggy Pop and Rolling Stones tours and all this kind of stuff. But now where we're at in your story is the fun's over. You stopped touring. You married a gal. You had a child. But the drinking, like it does, the disease progresses. And your drinking got more and more and more where you're out of control to where your wife left you. And then you tried to quit. You didn't believe the forebodings or the warnings, right, that you could die from an alcoholic detox without medical help, right?
Right.
And you went to the hospital six times.
Six times. I fell down a flight of stairs, cracked my head. I was just hopeless.
Hopeless.
And my father, just before Christmas, one of the last times I saw him, I was drunk, and we got in an argument about something, and he dropped me off at my place. His last words to me was, "You're helpless, hopeless, drunk, and you disgust me."
Ugh.
And my dad died of a heart attack a week later.
He never
saw me sober. My poor mother, the same thing. I put my mother through. I put everybody through hell. All my friends that just saw me killing myself. Oh, it was bad.
Yeah.
Drugs are bad.
Drugs are bad, okay?
Drinking's bad.
I mean, that's what happens to us,
and
right?
I got addicted. So, you know, I would look at a junkie and be disgusted. But,
yeah.
I mean, here I am, you know, worse than that.
I had a sponsee like that. He only drank beer. And he would drink beer out of a can from three nights ago with a cigarette in it. But he would go to the support meetings, right?
Right.
And he'd be like, "I never did drugs." It's like, dude, you have dog poop all over your room. You haven't changed your shirt in over a week. You smell like it doesn't matter what gets you there. When you're in that spot, we're all the same, right?
And, you know, it's what you put people through. You have no idea that, you know, the people that care for you.
You think you're only hurting yourself.
Yeah.
And you have no idea.
Yeah, you have no idea. The trail of devastation that you're just leaving from behind is just, and your
tornadoes,
friends,
right?
Your friends just get fed up at some point. My family got fed up, and how long can you watch somebody kill yourself? But so it ended up basically homeless in San Diego. I had a little place behind the San Diego Zoo in a canyon where I would go collect my morning cigarette butts from a church that looked like these people were rich because they left half cigarettes. So I'd take my little thing of and figure out how to steal a bottle of vodka from someplace. I don't know why it always ends up vodka with alcoholics, but it does. Vons vodka was my favorite, which has nothing to do with vodka. It's all chemical stuff. But I remember raining and being in the park, and it just dawned on me what happened. Used to be Mike Page, and
moment of clarity.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't really clarity. It was just disgust that this isn't working anymore. So I went to my little brother's place, and he actually made a telephone call from a guy. He said, "You can't keep doing this. Like, Mom has passed away. Dad has passed away. We have nobody else here. You're going to die, and I can't deal with it. Nobody can deal with it anymore.
This is your little brother?
You need help, my little brother guy." And he made a call, and a guy got on the phone, and he said, "Hey, I understand you're looking for, you might need some help." And I said, "Yeah, I think I maybe do. I think I do." And he said, "Well, call me when you're ready that you do. If you think you do, then maybe you're not ready." Mm-hmm. And it's like, "Hey, I'm ready because I got no place to sleep tonight," or whatever. So he put my
How long were you homeless for?
About 6-8 months, whatever. You know, I could keep little jobs here and there working in guitar shops. I wanted a rock and roll guy in the guitar shop until I started having a pint of vodka for lunch or whatever. It wouldn't last. None of my jobs would last very long.
Sure. And so what happened with that guy?
Well, he told my brother, and put my brother back on the phone, and the good news when it was done, he said, "Listen, I'll come pick you up tomorrow morning, and I'll get you a backstage pass. I know a place that'll take, it's a shelter or whatever that'll take you in, and I'll get you a backstage pass."
Did you just use that lingo to, like,
Yeah, kind to make it like rock and rollish or whatever.
Did you know he was doing that, or did you buy it?
No, I was at that time, I was just shot. I was done.
You're
I was
like,
ready
okay,
to do
it sounds
anything.
Great.
Yeah, so he put my brother back on the phone, and next thing my brother goes, well, we're going to the liquor store, and we're getting you a quart of vodka and a pack of smokes. And it's like, really? Where'd this come from? And he's going, well, it's going to be your last. That's the one that he just told me to do this. So he took me to 1111 Island, the detox center downtown. And just the street drunk place, the holding tank or whatever. But he took me to a hospital, got me a prescription for Dilantin, whatever it was, a stop cell called withdrawal seizures. I had to have that before going into treatment, and took me into the into a treatment center and told me they're going to feed you, bathe you, don't worry about anything. It's a 10-day program. You're going to detox. You have the medication, the whole thing. You need to do me a favor. When you walk in that place, I know the hell that you're going through, the hell that is your life right now. When you get inside, look back outside and wave to me and recognize that all your problems will be back outside. Listen to what they're saying in there.
Wow.
Because apparently he had gone in there many years earlier, and he said, just all you need to do is just listen with an open mind. So I did my detox thing 4 days or
whatever. That's cool that you remember that.
Yeah.
In the state you're in. That really impacted you.
Yeah, I didn't remember much of the 4 days. But then I had the moment of clarity in a room of 40 people, and they're all downtown street drunks.
Mm-hmm.
They ran the statistics of what the possibilities of recovery were, and they said out of you 40, it's only one or two are going to be sober the next 10 years. The rest are going to be dead in prison. And I look around the room, and I said, well, of course they're talking about me because these are all bums. And then all of a sudden, I said, wait a minute, how did I get in here? How did I get in here with the bums? I happened to listen to what they said, and they said you've got a fatal progressive disease that there's no cure for. And I kept waiting for a catch line or a phrase to say.
Yeah.
I was like, so you're just going to leave me there? That's what the reality is. And they said the only chance that you have is to get real with your creator, whoever that might be. You need to ask for help. And you need to, there's a program, a 12-step program. If you take those suggestions, you possibly get a 24-hour reprieval. And this is what it is you need to do. And you need to do it immediately. So I went to bed that night. And I remember it's a jail cell. I'm looking at bars in the windows in a full moon. It was right around Halloween, October 20th. And I put my hands together to do the prayer. Just say, hello, testing God. Is this mic on? This is Mike. You probably know it's Mike. God, hello, is this mic on? And all the dilly-dallying, I think I might need help. Maybe I think I, all of a sudden it was just cut the crap. God, I need help. Please help me. And that's what happened. It was crazy. I had an experience that night. And I was rocketed in the fourth dimension. I don't really hardly remember anything. I remember waking up in the morning and everything was different.
Wow.
And I had no idea what it was, but it was everything was different.
Wow.
And it took me a while to figure out what it was. And what it boiled down to is I got what I asked for. I got help. It took that addiction off of my shoulders, and I wasn't strapped with it anymore.
That's incredible.
It was crazy, and I was scared because it was the first time ever that I didn't, that was released. And they mentioned that they have a recovery programs that you might consider going into.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a recovery house in California called Pathfinders. It was the oldest recovery home in California with the highest rate of recovery, which is still devastatingly low, like 20% or whatever.
Which I do not like the stats because
it
really
shows
well, that's true. But of the people who are really, truly willing and do the work, I think the recovery rate is 98%. It's more about when they say only 5% recover. Yeah, the other 95% don't do what it takes to recover, in my opinion.
Originally, they were saying, are you ready to go to any length?
Right.
And I said, yeah, except I do have a daughter that I need to blah, blah, blah. And they're going, wait a minute, that's not any length. Yesterday, you said you were willing to go to any length.
Yeah.
So I almost talked my way out of getting into a recovery home that way. I told them I couldn't say 9 months. I couldn't dedicate that time to it.
You had limitations.
Yeah. And so they said, well, good, thanks for telling us because we don't need you then. We got another 50 guys in line here. And I was like, oh, my God. So I got into Pathfinders, and I listened to what they said, and I found the community that was there where I wasn't a completely alone guy that was crazy. There were other people that were drinking like I was drinking. and recognize it was in that camaraderie. That's how the program works, talking one alcoholic to another.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
it's like,
you're
oh,
not
you
alone.
Mean, I'm not from Mars, and I don't have all these problems. And then you can start laughing at it. What's the worst one you had? And that happens to all my rock friends. That I,
right.
I'm so grateful now for the rock and roll guys to see where us older guys went wrong and or that are still alive. Most of them are dead.
Sure.
And they got hip to what it is, that lifestyle. You can't really do any of that. But
what are you going to do? I joke, but, you know, I say, what are you going to do? You're going to, like, shoot dope like a gentleman and have a nice little family and be 60-year-old and just shoot dope once in a while? You know what I mean? What do you do? Smoke meth just like a gentleman and just have a little tweaker family?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, it's just normal not... people get it out of their system. They do it for a bit, and they say, and it's not for them or whatever. But when you're addicted and whatever. But so I did the full 9-month program. And they taught me everything. They taught me that the world doesn't revolve around me, that there's other things.
That's earth-shattering.
And for Thanksgiving, we would go to Goodwill and do turkey dinners and clean up and do this.
So you give it back, being a service?
Oh,
yeah.
So all of a sudden I started like, oh, I get it. If you help other people, then you pull yourself out of your hamster cage, stupid thinking mind or whatever, long enough to help somebody else. Then everybody benefits from it. I just learned the simple things, how to make my bed, how to be responsible. It was really tough. We're going through the steps with my sponsor about how to why you dress my daughter, where there was, you know, years of being on the road or being drunk and not being a good dad. And I worked with him and wrote her a letter and asked her at some point in the future if you might consider letting me have another chance of being the best dad that I can. And I started a new relationship with my daughter that's the best. She's in the south of France right now. I'm just proud papa all the way.
I love that stuff.
In south of France, working with a special effects company that does special effects for movies for the motion picture industry. She's traveling like her dad did, just London and Germany. And so she's been working with me for, when I got sober, and it was very, I didn't want to know about music, rock and roll. I didn't want to get into doing any of that, but I started scoring for film. And I got picked up by a company in San Diego, Passmore Lab, through a friend of mine. Daryl introduced me to Passmore. And they were doing 3D way before anybody else was doing 3D stereo.
Yeah.
And the National Geographic type quality. Mm-hmm. They hired me to be their music composer for the for their projects. And I got paid way more than I did in rock and roll, and it was just like a cush job that was unbelievable.
Isn't it crazy?
You look at all these pictures and create music for it from your libraries, and they saw I had organizational abilities, and I brought in Disney and Technicolor, some other companies like that. This is pre-Avatar. So I got hooked into technology through music, and eventually moved to Los Angeles and started my own 3D stereo company and became a consultant for Panasonic Hollywood Laboratory, their only stereo consultant. And which is funny because I know nothing about 3D. Right now I do virtual reality.
This is the stuff that happens when you get sober.
That's it.
Miracles happen, right?
I just surround myself with experts that know how to do this, and I position people and then just help things out. But I learned basically all these tricks that we learn in recovery that I use 10, 20, 30 times a day.
Right.
Of just like all those. I am so grateful for having those tools. And they happen. And when you recognize it, all the different, the small stuff, all the silly sayings that they have, like don't sweat the small stuff and baby steps and all that, they just make insane sense and they work.
Yeah.
And so
that's incredible. So
when you're not totally whacked or whatever, then you can explore other things, spiritual things. And I got
that work for you.
Self-realization was just a good one. They honor the saints of all religions.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have time to explore that and do that and helping other people.
Which is a spiritual high in and of itself.
So now I've developed and running a virtual a VR company that is focused on wellness and therapy and helping out in positive ways.
Beautiful. So, Michael.
Music is the one. Have you seen the movie Alive Inside?
I have not.
Oh, my God.
I got to see it.
Oh, my God. It's Netflix. You can watch
it. Okay. I'm always looking for something good.
It's a guy.
Especially stuff like that.
It's a guy that takes headsets, music headsets, to old folks' homes, people that have been comatose, for years, and they put music on them, and you watch them come alive and dance and jump out of a bed when they've been paralyzed. All
this. Oh, my gosh, I got to see this.
You look at the power of what that is. My buddy Christian that turned me on to this and introduced us.
It's called Alive Inside.
Alive Inside.
I'm going to watch it tonight.
God. You'll cry. I guarantee you'll cry.
I guarantee.
The power of music, what it does, is so powerful over human beings and these people that are old.
And that's what Rock to Recovery is all about. But listen, we're almost out of time. And I could talk to you all night, and I want to just, there's so much more great. I mean, we're sitting here on Rock to Recovery Radio with Michael Page, played with Chubby Checker and Iggy Pop and New York Dolls, which turned into The Criminals.
Yes.
Right?
I
mean, on and on, doing 3D stuff with the cinema and soundtracks, and I could go on and on. I mean, the story's incredible, and thank you for sharing your vulnerability and your story with us, because it's all about what we try to do in Rock to Recovery is show people out there that there is a way out, that you can be in a industry rife with challenges like a musician or entertainment industry professional and still make it out and have a sober, incredible life that gets even better.
It's the alternative. We didn't have one in those days, whatever, but they have. And the alternative to life and just and goodness is just, it just makes so much sense. I'm so grateful. I'm so happy that the word got spread anyway to the younger people. You don't have to mess with that. You don't need to throw your life away. You can get into living.
There's a way out, isn't there?
There's a way out.
You're never too sick?
That's the most important thing, is knowing that there's a way out.
And you're not alone,
you're
right?
You're not alone.
You're not alone. So, Michael Page, it is the greatest honor and privilege to have sat here with you
it's
for
so
this
cool
last
to
hour.
It's so cool to meet you and to be here at this whole this place.
Everybody listening is probably going, this Michael Page is a cool dude, man. Seriously, your energy, and you have so much love in your heart. And I'm so happy that...
It's gratitude for being only given a second chance.
Hallelujah.
Every day.
Amen to that. So, Michael, thanks for driving down to Laguna. This is Wes Skier, Rock to Recovery Radio on KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM. The show was brought to you also in part by New Vista Behavioral Health. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We're out of here.
We just wanna feel good. We just wanna feel